Welcome to How'd You Think of That? I'm Jalene Bailey. Today, our host, Temple Grandin, talks to Mimi Lufkin, an educator and advocate who served as the Chief Executive Officer of the National Alliance for Partnerships and Equity for more than 20 years. Grandin and Lufkin discuss the many ways to help students build STEM skills and access STEM careers.
Temple, how are you?
I am just fine.
Well, I'm excited to get to talk to you. I have to admit, I followed you for quite a long time. I used to be an ag teacher. Anyway, and of course, my career as it shifted, you know, always in education, but shifting more towards equity, the work that you, your advocacy for diverse thought and engaging students with disabilities has always been an inspiration. So thank you.
The National Alliance for Partnerships and Equity is dedicated to increasing student access, educational equity, and workforce diversity. One of their programs is Make the Future, which is designed to encourage girls, especially girls of color, to pursue advanced manufacturing careers.
We have a project called Make the Future. If you have an opportunity to go check it out, I would encourage you to. And it was funded by Toyota USA Foundation. And it's about providing educators with the tools that they need to recruit students from underserved communities, students who, women, girls, students of color, who typically don't enroll in advanced manufacturing programs, even pathway programs at the secondary school to community college programs where they can get an advanced manufacturing technical degree certificate at the same time that they're working in industry. And so they're paid to go to school. I mean, the apprenticeship opportunities, it's amazing what some of these companies are doing now in order to build a workforce, a diverse workforce that they need to fulfill their worker shortage. And if you can't find enough workers in this country, what are they going to do? They'll go overseas. And that is not what this economy needs.
What I'm seeing is kids growing up today where they've never used tools,
They've
never measured anything with a ruler. I just went to a really beautiful children's museum in Jackson, Mississippi, that was funded mostly by private industry, some of the big factories, where it's aimed at like toddlers, like young elementary school kids, where you can crank cranks and gears turn, and you can operate a machine that picks up pool noodles.
Right.
Just a lot of hands-on things. It's a real low-income area. Mm-hmm. And they also had a really cool agriculture museum, their sports museum. And what I think private industry in this situation is realizing, we got to get these kids young. This museum was aimed at little kids. You know, there was like water play things in there with balls floating in it and lots of little things they could turn.
What I think people don't understand, it's sort of not common knowledge, is that we begin to create our sense of our future careers, kids do, around what careers are for us and what careers are not, at about the age of six. And when people get crazy about middle school students trying to identify career options, you know, that it's too early for them to make choices, you know, it's like maybe it's too early to make uninformed choices, which means one of the things that we really need to be doing, especially in elementary and middle school, is providing students with an opportunity to explore, like what you're talking about, and to connect that to what careers there are out there and to see people that look like them doing those careers so that they can begin to make that connection. Because typically what happens is most of us choose a career based on what our parents did.
Yeah, that's right.
Or what our relatives do, or our family members. And so there's been studies about women who've entered into engineering fields, and most of them had fathers who were engineers or someone in their family who was an engineer that helped mentor them.
That's right.
Into that career.
And it gets back to exposure. I had super good mentors. Let's start out with my mother always pushing me to try and do new things, but not throwing me in the deep end of the pool. She'd always give me choices. Well, you can try this or you can try that. I had a great speech teacher, mother always pushing me. And I had a fantastic third grade teacher. A regular big high school was a complete disaster. Mm. I got thrown out of ninth grade for fighting and throwing a book at a girl, called me a retard.
Oh, geez.
And I went away to a special school for kids with problems. And for the first 3 years, they put me to work running a horse barn.
Oh, really?
Well, I learned how to work. And I'm realizing now
horses will do that to you.
How important that was. I was having a really tough time with adolescence. I was constantly bullied and teased, even at the special school. Yeah. And the only places I had friends was through shared interests, horseback riding, model rockets, and electronics. And then Mr. Carlock, my science teacher, came on the scene. And he got me interested in studying because now studying was a pathway to a goal. Another super important mentor was my aunt out at the ranch. And that's how I got introduced to the cattle industry. And then to get my business started, there was a contractor, a former Marine Corps captain, starting a small concrete steel business. And he wanted to design and build cattle handling facilities. And he had seen some of my drawings. So he seeked me out. He was another very important mentor in getting my business started. Now, wow. The thing about mentors is they could see ability.
Beyond teachers and mentors, students often face issues of equity and access during the interviewing and hiring process. In 2000, Claudia Golden and Cecilia Rouse conducted a controversial study that found that when orchestras audition blind, that is, without being able to see or identify the candidate, they hired more women. Malcolm Gladwell cites the study in his book Blink. Though the study has largely been discredited since, it serves as an illustration for the barriers that students face as they attempt to enter the workforce.
Another thing we got to do is get rid of the regular interview process. The way I used to get jobs, that I've always been self-employed until I became a college professor, and I've only been a part-time college professor, and the other time self-employed, is I simply showed people copies of my work. I used my work to sell myself. Mm-hmm. I would just lay the drawings out on the table and show them to people. And here are the drawings, some of the drawings that I use are in my book, Thinking in Pictures. I would simply show those to people and show them photographs of jobs. In other words, show off the work.
So I want to go back to a couple of ideas that you've mentioned. Okay. One is this notion about sort of alternative methods around interviewing. And there was a lot of research that was done around interview bias. And I don't know if you've ever heard about the piece that was done around orchestras where they...
Oh, I saw that. That was in that Malcolm Gladwell book. And they put the people behind a curtain. And the women and the men did equally well on the... when they were playing their musical instrument behind a curtain compared to when they were visible. Yes, I think.
Right, right. The human bias that, you know, that we all have, I mean, that's all part of human nature. And part of it is, you know, understanding your own bias in order to be able to, create an equitable view of who you're engaging with and opportunity.
I'm familiar with those dreadful resume studies. Well, you put a girl's name on it or you put some other name on it. And maybe you need to just put the resumes out there with no names on them.
Lovkin and Grandin discuss how education can be diversified to set up students who think visually for success.
The two kinds of thinking complement each other. And what worries me is my kind of mind, the object visualizer, we're screened up at the algebra requirement. I can't do algebra in the abstract and never have been able to do it. I got out of it just on a fluke on what was required in a 1967 math course.
So flexibility of educational opportunity in terms of, you know, really addressing learning differences and learning styles and all of that is so important. And there always seems, I don't know, maybe this is my bias, but in education, there's this, there's one way to Rome, and we all know that there are lots of ways to get there, right? And we need to figure out a way to diversify our educational options rather than trying to create everybody has to have algebra in eighth grade.
I used to think everyone thought in pictures the way I did when I was young in my 20s.
I bet you did. Yeah.
I thought everyone thought in pictures, and I was absolutely shocked when I discovered other people think verbally. You know, now there's scientific research to show that there is different ways people think. And I discuss it in the autistic brain. There's research for the optic visualizer like me exists and thinks in pictures, and then a visual spatial, more pattern thinking, mathematical and musical mind. And they're actually kind of opposite traits. And there's a lot of people that are kind of mixtures of the two, but mm-hmm. you're not going to find a super good object visualizer. That would be the clever engineering department and the super good visual spatial in the same person. They're kind of right. Opposite traits. And even though that book's getting, you know, it's been a few years old now, all the new research, which I have looked at, supports what I'm saying. It supports it even more.
I don't know if you're familiar with Cheryl Sorby's work, but this in at the University of Michigan, I think that's where she was. And she did a lot of work on spatial visualization and the skill development around spatial visualization, especially for young girls, because of the types of toys they play with when early on in their lives and how they're not, you know, that all this stuff about women in STEM thing has been, you know, such a big issue for the last 20 years. And there was a research piece that she did around looking at entry into engineering programs at the university level and how much lower performing women were in the spatial visualization skills. And it was one of the skill sets that was part of the very first introduction to engineering courses that was sort of the gateway to getting into the engineering major. And so it was carving out all of these women from accessing...
Is I took a biomedical, and sorry about interrupting, I have a problem with timing. Tried to take a biomedical engineering course when I was getting my master's, and I had to drop it because of the math. But the thing is, you need my kind of mind to avoid mistakes like that horrible metal on metal artificial hip joint that put bad stuff out into people's bodies. I don't think I would have made that mistake. And in looking at some of the research, we're seeing that the visual thinker, the more industrial design person, looks at engineering in a different way than the pure mathematician. And you need to have both. They bring different ways of solving problems. And what I have found is that sometimes the extremely simple things are hard to think up. My grandfather was the co-inventor of the autopilot for planes. And he worked with a person that was probably autistic who came up with this idea of three little coils, very simple, no moving parts. And people in aviation thought it was crazy. They didn't think it would work.
Huh.
They made it work. It was in every plane during World War II.
Wow.
Sometimes the most obvious is the least obvious. Study that I read about, it was either in Science or Nature. I don't remember which one. I get those two mixed up because it's so similar. And when you're going to go solving a problem, do you make it simpler and maybe remove something? Or do you add complexity? It's kind of like, well, how does bureaucracy grow? And they went to university and looked through all of the rules, and they very seldom removed a rule. I always used to say on a lot of stuff I designed, think simple.
It's a rare thing that I get to take time out of my day to have to talk about thinking. Actually, this is an area that I haven't done much reading about or studying, but this whole notion about how to creative mind thinking. So, you know, does technology suppress because it's so passive in its engagement that, you know, I don't have to do anything. I just sit here and it happens to me where if I have to create my own toys, create my own spaces, create the things that make me happy and have fun, I would think might be a better thing, but it's certainly a challenge, and things are changing so fast. Oh my gosh, the fact that you and I can be sitting in two different places in the country and having this conversation and feeling very comfortable about it, that's just amazing to me.
Well, there's a lot of good things, you know, going on with technology. Okay, let's say we go out and we study leaves, different kinds of leaves, or you go out and get some different kinds of plants or flowers that you look at and take pictures of them and then look them up online and see what they are. I'm absolutely fine with that. But I'm seeing things where kids are getting so separated from the world, the practical, that I had a teacher say to me in all seriousness, this is one of the projects out of my book, Calling All Minds. And this teacher said, well, what's going to happen to kids' self-esteem if they make a paper snowflake and fell apart? And I said, another piece of paper and you try again.
Well, and the whole notion that everything always has to be perfect. you know, we have this sort of failure mentality about our education systems. And the thing is that if engineers didn't fail, what would this world be like?
They probably would have never built anything.
That's right. Exactly. See, it's all about failure.
You learn from your mistakes. And I think some of this problem with kids being really afraid of failure, I've run into this a whole lot. Well, and find out they're growing up and they totally don't work with anything in the real world. I can remember wrecking a sewing project when I was maybe 13 because I cut the fabric too quickly and hastily. And I had to throw the whole thing away. I didn't have enough fabric to do it over.
Right.
And you know, learn from that. Be more careful before you cut it next time.
The ultimate isn't the end. It's the process of getting there. And I think that's a hard notion for anybody. I won't say it's just for kids today, but anybody, because we're such an immediate gratification society.
Learning about cattle handling, I went to every feed yard in Arizona about and worked cattle to see how they worked in different designs of chutes. Some systems worked well, some systems worked badly. And then after going to a whole lot of systems, I picked out all the good design bits and I recombined them together into better designs. My thinking's bottom up. And what I've learned about verbal thinking is very top down. You have a broad concept, okay, like diverse minds, but you don't really have much guidance on how to implement it. Mm-hmm. That's going to take the bottom up thinker, where my mind puts things into categories. Okay, I found this category that on a real sunny day, cattle did not like to go into dark buildings. And I found maybe 3 or 4 facilities that had that problem. So that went in a sunny day, dark building category, like on a spreadsheet. Of something that doesn't work. And then I found other things that did work in curved facilities. They have to be laid out just right. So as the animal enters a single file chute, he has to be able to see up there 2 body lengths. You bend it too sharp, it doesn't work. So that's another feature.
So I want to know, how is it that someone who I'm sure in your lifetime have probably, you know, run into a lot of people who wouldn't have seen the talents that you had and were more concerned about the way in which you see the world or behave. You've been amazingly successful and have influenced so many people and got this focus about you. Give me some advice.
Well, I think
what are the lessons you've learned?
One of the things I think helps old-fashioned 50s upbringing, where basic manners were taught. The method I call teachable moments. So we're sitting at the dining room table. And if I stick my finger into the mashed potatoes or something like that, mother would say, use the fork. They would just give the instruction. Also working skills learned at a really young age.
So you've had a lot of people in your life who've encouraged you along the way?
Oh, yes. I had super good mentors. But for me, it's been a journey because when I was in my 20s, I thought everybody thought in pictures.
Just like you.
And there's a lot of people discovering when they're older that their thinking is different from other people. And it's kind of an eye opener.
And I wonder how much our thinking changes as we, age too.
I'm still a visual thinker. Now, what changes is I think I've got better at thinking because as I've gotten older, I have more and more data in the database. So I didn't really think that I was good at thinking until I was nearly 40. And I had gotten out, and it's important to get these kids that are different out doing a lot of things. One thing that Elon Musk did, he did a lot of travel.
Yeah.
He was exposed to a lot of diverse things. And he was also exposed to science fiction books like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that he really liked, but got out and did a lot of things. If you have a kid with an autism label that just stays in his house all day, you don't fill the database with more information.
Well, and what you're talking about too is about privilege, right? What kids have the privilege of having parents who have the resources to be able to take them and travel like that.
All right, let's just look at resources in the neighborhood. Find a retired mechanic and you fix lawnmower engines. One teacher got the kids out calculating how electronic parking meters worked. Mm-hmm. You know, just doing things in the neighborhood, go in the park and count birds. None of these projects are expensive, but I'm amazed, like during the lockdowns, watched crows sort of arguing with each other on an electric wire. Crows decided that they didn't like drinking middle of the street puddle water, but they drink the water that was in the grass. And
well, it's all about developing observation.
And let's make things for them to do. We got to get them off the devices and let's get them doing some other things.
You're right.
And we're right. Using the device to take pictures of stuff you're doing outside. That's fine. Now, where's a big place where you have a problem is, you know, a parent might be working two jobs, is totally stressed out. And this is where the schools need to be. That's why we need to be putting hands-on classes back in the schools. And if the schools say they can't afford it, let's work in the neighborhood on how, you know, there's a lot of retirees that would like to teach an art class or teach the kids how to fix lawnmower engines or do something with a 3D printer. They're not very expensive now. That gets both hands-on and the programming. In fact, recently I was at a maker lab in Salt Lake City and I watched an autistic kid come in, 12 years old, acting pretty autistic-y, and he got involved with that 3D printer and it took an hour and 20 minutes to print little plastic fighter jet. And he was just fascinated by that. And he was interacting a lot more with people.
Yeah, the whole makerspace movement is just, I think it's great.
Well, and we can do that without real expensive things. Like I'm seeing an example. I went stayed at a hotel about 6 weeks ago that was behind an appliance store. And I just saw big sheets of flattened cardboard back there. And I'm going, that would be a great materials is free. Why don't we have kids making stuff out of it?
It's been great, Temple, getting a chance to chat with you. And I could do this all night.
And it was great talking to you. I'm going to leave the meeting. Okay, bye.
That was Temple Grandin and advocate Mimi Lovkin. This is How'd You Think of That?
Thank you so much for listening.
How'd You Think of That is a production of the Utah STEM Action Center in partnership with SQ Media. Thanks to Jolene Bailey for production assistance and music compositions by Rebecca Baker.
This podcast is based upon work supported by the National Science Foundation under grant number 174-5674.